morning and welcome to the St. Patrick's Day edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my Irish co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Top of the morning.
Top of the morning, exactly. Okay, we're going to start our morning by speaking with Grace Williams. She's the author of Give Her Credit, a book about the founding of the Women's Bank of Denver. Then we'll be joined by Jack Danos of Cold Slayer. He's going to tell us exactly what those guys have cooking. Spoiler alert, it's about your feet.
And speaking of cooking, we'll get the lowdown on this culinary takeover that's happening at the St. Regis from Chefs Abrams, Chef Lerman, and Chef Mauro. We'll end the hour with J.K., John Kenworthy of Flanagan's. After all, it is St. Patrick's Day. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
March is Women's History Month, and this morning we are lucky to be joined by author Grace Williams, whose new book, Give Her Credit, not only tells the story of the Women's Bank of Denver, but provides some fascinating insights into how women were treated from a financial perspective in the 1970s and before. We're very lucky to be joined by her this morning. Good morning, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So, Grace, tell us a little bit about what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
I had been informed about these women who formed the Women's Bank in Denver, and it opened the year that I was born. And about 20 years after that, I was my first summer in New York City. I had no money. I had no credit. I had no anything. And I was given this opportunity to apply for a credit card without anyone vouching for me as a viable credit candidate. So just me signing me myself and my social security number and a credit card. And when I learned that successful women, educated women, women with plenty of money in a portfolio 20 years before in their own bank because they couldn't get credit, while a nobody like myself did, I just couldn't believe this. And I said, okay, I'm all in. Give me the info. So
let's flesh that out a little bit. Can you give an audience a bit more about how women were regarded by banks and other financial institutions as late as the 1970s?
Sure. So this is an interesting sort of paradox because there was an understanding that as consumers, women held so much control over the family purse strings, and they were primarily like the target demographic from Madison Avenue advertisers, right? So obviously there's an understanding, okay, women spend money, women have the financial power, but the power only extended to a certain spot. And after that, it was more considered like a man's world or a man's issue. And this was wild to me because why wouldn't somebody who cares about, you know, the price of orange juice, right, at this supermarket versus that one, also think about the price of a stock or a bond? Why wouldn't they care about it? And it's not that they didn't, it's that they just weren't being targeted and they weren't being marketed to and they weren't having the discussion. No one was really discussing it with them. And so I would say one of the terms that I used is that they were sort of infantilized or treated like paper dolls, which is the cutout of somebody that you pop out of the little cardboard and you put in outfits and they go on an adventure, but they're very flat. They're one dimensional. Money, I guess, was treated in women with money, maybe more one dimensional. And obviously that's changed now because we're worried about retirement, divorce, all kinds of things. But none of this was presented to women, I don't think, in a fair and honest way back then. Hmm. Yeah.
Now, did banks really ignore the income of women of childbearing age and ask intrusive questions about family planning?
Yeah, all the research that I found and, you know, also women that I spoke to said, oh, yes, this absolutely 1,000% happened. Huh. And the other one that was interesting, which didn't get in the book because I found out later from a woman who wrote to me. So she said one of the things they also had to do was if you had an engagement ring, you would turn it around or not wear it because you might be asked about, okay, what's the story here? So they could really be so invasive. But yes, Carol Green, one of my characters in the book, they went to buy this beautiful house. And she was the sort of the driving force behind their family business. And they weren't going to count her income, even though she had, I want to say, at least two, maybe a third child by then. because they said she could get pregnant at any time, and then she was expected to just no longer make money. But she was making crazy money. It was unbelievable.
And what year are we looking at?
We're looking at probably 72 or 3 is going to be my guess.
And by that time, wasn't there already legislation that would sort of prohibit that kind of discrimination?
So, no, there was a bill coming, which was introduced in 1974. That's the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. That didn't have to actually fully come in until 1976. So there was definitely space in there.
And so one of the wonderful things about the beginning of the book is you're setting this world, right, where you're talking about some of these successful women who just are being ignored by the financial institutions. And you also talk about women who actually are participating within sort of the banking industries and the travails they suffered. And we'll get to that in some more detail later. But you sort of are setting the stage, and then we sort of say it's the Ford administration. Why was Denver during the Ford administration the right time and the right place for a women's bank?
So that's a fabulous question. And when you ask the women, and that's who I'll defer to, one of the things that they will say is that it was just very happening at that moment. You had a lot of successful women who were pouring into the workforce. You had just a boom time in Colorado itself. And you also had a lot of people who maybe didn't regard themselves directly as feminists, but who cared a lot about feminine issues and issues that impacted women. And I mean, the reason why the bank was the success that it was, of course, is because of the woman that ran it, the primary runner of it, which was Luray Arulian.
And we'll get to her, but the other thing you sort of talked about that I thought was really interesting in terms of a confluence of vectors is the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment at the congressional level anyway, as sort of setting the stage.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was an important thing that was in the paper. I did a lot of research and found through the Denver Post, this was in the paper constantly. This was at the heart and forefront of so many people. They really believed this was going to push forward what they needed to get the things that they were feeling, you know, they weren't getting, which is the equality. And so it absolutely belonged there and still does. It belongs in the conversation.
So now the book is filled with stories about driven and very capable women. Can you go into a little more detail with our listeners about Carol Green and then Betty Friedman, please?
Sure. And this is great. So I spoke to Carol Green directly several times, and Betty Friedman, I recreated through her children. So these are like very different stories. But yes, Carol Green. So the Women's Bank actually started in her living room, and she was someone who, I'm trying to think of the best way to frame her. I mean, she made a major life change when she was in her late 20s, early 30s, and ended up receiving lots and lots of confidence through the life change. She lost a bunch of weight through Weight Watchers. And through her speaking engagements in Weight Watchers meetings, the executives said, okay, she's great. We want her to open a franchise with us and be a partner. And she wisely decided, you know what, I don't think I want to be a partner. I think I want to open my own. And ended up opening up her first franchise with her husband in Denver. They're from the East Coast. They relocated to Denver. She grew the franchise exponentially and ended up running the Rocky Mountain region of Weight Watchers. This is like a huge deal for her at this time, for a woman. And when it was time for them to sort of upgrade their lifestyle and buy the home they wanted to, that's when she discovered this is the limitation. I mean, she was limitless for so long, growing a business, relocating, raising a family, doing it all, Chamber of Commerce, Boy Scouts. Then when it's time to go to the bank and say, okay, we're ready, we want to buy this house, the bank says, sorry, you could get pregnant, we can't give you money. And as a go-getter, she said, fine, okay, whatever. And they figured out what they were going to do instead. But it always sort of chewed at the back of her mind that it just wasn't fair. And when she had a rare moment of solitude in a hospital, she saw something about a bank opening in New York for women. and said, oh, you know what? I wonder if we could do this here in Denver. Could a woman run a bank in Denver? And then she was just on fire, and she rallied people, and, you know, they started in living rooms just like Weight Watchers meetings, and things grew exponentially, and she was there from start to finish. So she's the provider of the chairs that were filled with the founding members.
Excellent. And so what stories did you get from Betty Friedman's kids?
Oh, she was great. So one of the things I loved about her was her ability to just be like a mover and a shaker and a socialite. The idea of socialites getting involved in starting a woman's bank, it just appealed to me so much. Her son especially helped speak with me so much about just her as a person, the way she could write, her love of making sure that, you know, Denver could be beautiful. She had issues, I guess, with being out west. She wanted to be on the East Coast. She wanted to be more in the F. Scott Fitzgerald, Great Gatsby sort of world. But the West was calling, and so that's where she was born, and that's where she ended up after she went to school at Goucher over in Baltimore, and did a few other little stops and whatevers. But she said, okay, fine, if I can't have the East Coast life that I want on the East Coast, I'm going to bring things that I've sort of like picked up, and we'll do it here. So she was huge into fundraising for the art museum and brought all kinds of artists and musicians into Denver. She was responsible for helping raise all the money for the public library, just all kinds of stuff. She learns about this bank and she says, okay, great, I'm in. And she brought sort of this like glam element to something that's going to be otherwise a little bit more like a quote unquote man's world, if you will. And so she would like sit and read the New Yorker and talk with her husband about it. There were just so many things about Betty that her son John told me that I loved.
Awesome. So now these founders, what did they envision as the mission for the bank?
So there was actually philosophical differences about that. And this is an important thing to really, you know, underscore. At the beginning, it was, do we want to just, you know, open up and give money out, which you can't do if you're a bank, right?
No.
It doesn't work because then the bills come due and then you get foreclosed or you get evicted, right? So once they sort of figured out their philosophical issues and sort of like said, okay, this is what we want to do. They wanted the name Women's in the bank. It needed to be Women's for sure. That was one sticking point. They wanted to provide people the ability to open a bank account or a checking account. And the third thing was, if you weren't eligible to get credit, they wanted to educate you as to why and how you could go and then sort of build credit. So they worked with people. And if you were a viable credit candidate, then you could get credit. And if you couldn't, they'd give you the reason why. And sometimes one of the things that was maddening to me was that prior to some of these laws and some of these changes, I could go to my bank and be told, yeah, you can't have credit. And if I say why, they didn't have to tell me. The laws changed that you had to then tell the person why. But Women's Bank offered up the reason why immediately. You're not eligible because you don't have credit, but do this to establish it, that kind of stuff. So they really were sort of walking hand in hand with people. And they wanted to have fun. They were very jovial and they had a great time doing this.
So they held their customers' hands to make them better customers, it seemed.
Yes, and loyal, because that's another thing. If you go somewhere and somebody says, okay, you can't do this, but let me see what I can do for you to get you to this. We're going to make a goal to get you here. That person is probably not going to go anywhere else ever again. And they understood that.
There are a lot of stories about how the idea of getting this off the ground went from concept to reality. A lot of stories about meetings in Carol Green's and other people's living rooms. What were some of the challenges that the organizers of the bank had to overcome?
I think starting up something like that from scratch is a major challenge when you don't have anyone who's got sort of a financial background. And so at the beginning of this, the start of this, yes, you had Betty, who was a fundraiser. You had Carol, who's an entrepreneur, but they don't know about regulations and laws and what you have to do. And so they really just got on the phone and called and said, okay, how do we start a bank? It's like start bank 101 kind of a thing. This is definitely a challenge in terms of, did you want to be a nationally chartered or a state chartered bank? This was a definite argument and sort of, do we want to do this? Should we do this? We don't know. We're not sure. Debate that went on quite a bit. Where to locate themselves, because you could have one bank in one location only. You couldn't have a branch bank. And so sort of those brass tacks and those nitty gritty details definitely were some of the things that they went back and forth about. But once they got some people in there who actually had the financial backgrounds, who could help shore up whatever the loose ends were, then they were gangbusters. They were not going to be stopped. The only thing that could have stopped them was being told you can't organize, or after being told you could organize, you can't open. So the start of it was very slow, and getting things off the ground was slow. But by the time they got those financial folks in, that was it took off like lightning.
And obviously, you have to be able to raise, for a bank to open, it's got to have, equity. You got to have stockholders. How are they able to attract stockholders?
I think this is kind of goes back to that first question where you say, or that other earlier question where you say, how was this for Denver? Why was it for Denver? It was a moment where a lot of people said, we believe in this and we want to do this. So they needed to be capitalized at, I'm blanking, I think it's 2 million. I think it's 2 million.
That's my recollection, is that was in the book.
Okay. Yeah, I should know this. I haven't read it in so long. I skim it on occasion for stuff, but the facts don't always come to the forefront of my head. But yeah, it was $2 million, I want to say. And they sold shares. It was like $10 a share. And people just said, we love it, And everybody knew somebody who would be at least interested in buying one share. And when that sort of that wide net was cast, there was a lot of support from a lot of people, including men. We got to definitely say men also supported it. And it was, again, one of those things where you're calling around, you're talking to your colleagues, you get the attention of some really good groups, and it takes off from there. So they sold their initial offering out. I want to say, I feel like it was within a month, or it was a very short time period. Compared to other banks that were trying to do this. So it was fast.
There's a wonderful sequence in the book that seems very 1970s to me, where they're trying to locate a woman with prominent expertise in the financial arena, and they see an article in a magazine, and they write a bunch of letters. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. This was a Business Week article that tackled the top women in business at the time. And there's actually a page in the archive that lists all these women, and this one is in there too. So banking and finance was one of the categories, and they found, I forget, it was like six women. So they found a bunch of women who were in banking and finance, and Betty Friedman actually went and wrote to all of them and said, would you be interested? We're thinking about starting up a bank. Any chance you'd be interested in learning more? The bank would be for women. And also, it's a very important distinction that John would punch me in the face if I don't say. Well, he doesn't punch, but you know what I mean. He'd get me for it. She signed the letters, Mrs. Marshall Friedman, which is her husband's name. So still very old school, presenting something very new to people. And so they didn't hear back from everybody, but they did hear back from a woman out of Trenton. That's going to be Mary Roebling, who became their mentor and their den mother, essentially, and was just such a fun character to discover.
Yeah. Now, when they opened the bank, what was the location that they chose, and why did they choose that location?
Sure. So they chose to open up in a suite in a building that's called the Equitable Building. It stretches back to the 1800s. It's one of the most elegant structures in Denver, which, that's saying a lot because there's a lot of very elegant structures there, to be quite honest, and they're very well-preserved landmarks. So Equitable was owned by a company called Equitable Life and Insurance, But obviously, we love the name Equitable in general because they're bringing equitable money, right? And the suite that they were in was a little bit more modest, but the building itself is a stunning structure. It just, they imported lots of marble. There's Tiffany glass. You go in there and it just will take your breath away. And by being in this space, they were saying, you know, we are very serious. We are also very elegant people and we can definitely do this. And it's important to also explain. So Equitable is on 17th Street, which is sort of Denver's Wall Street, if you will. So here we are and here we stay. So they're sending a great message.
There are a couple of parallel stories that are going on in the book. One is about how women dealt with the financial world from the outside. And one is about how women within the financial world were dealt with. So with that, you also tell parallel stories. As a Utah radio station, the story of LaRue Aurelian is particularly interesting to us. Can you tell us about LaRue and her and what she discovered about Mahogany Row?
Oh, gosh, sure. So, and she, you know, obviously first choice for the lead because her story is so cool. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, where would you like me to start? Would you like me to start with her childhood in Salt Lake? Like, where do we want to begin? Okay. Because I could go on about, I mean, I could write a whole other book just about her. And they told me to cut it. You got to cut it short. So LaRue Aurelian, she was born in Salt Lake City. She's part of the Mormon community and is actually still quite a devout Mormon. When she got older, she was looking for a way to pay for college and had two choices. One choice was working for the phone book, and the other choice was working as a messenger at a bank in her town. And decided, okay, you know what? I'm going to go and apply to the bank. Got the job there. At the same time, she was also preparing for a marriage to a gentleman in her community who was leaving for a 2-year mission. And from the very start at her job, the people in charge realized that she was very good at her job as a messenger. So they promoted her within several times. She did coin wrapping. She helped to prepare documents for loans. I think she actually even helped write loans at a certain point. And as this is going on in the background of her life, of course, comes the question, okay, I'm doing great at this bank. Do I want to do this or do I want to go and, you know, follow the traditional path of my community? She ultimately decided she really, really wanted to have a career in finance. And part of that being this little area in the bank where she would slip off to on occasion and just look around. She called it Mahogany Row. This is where all the executive suites were, the executive rooms. And she just loved the artwork and the quiet and the furniture and just thought, someday I want to be on Mahogany Row. This is what she called it or nicknamed it. And obviously, there's no real right choice you can make. You have to decide, you know, choose your adventure. Do you want to chase Mahogany Row or do you want to chase the tradition? And she ultimately said, I'm going to go and do this. I want to work. I want a career in finance. So she broke off her engagement. She left Salt Lake and was driving. She was going to drive east. She was going to work on Wall Street one day. And she had several stops along her drive. And the first one was Denver. And she ended up staying. She stopped. She was going to just work jobs, you know, between towns. So she stayed in Denver. She got a job at a bank and stayed there. And
And she rises to a fairly high level at the bank. But then, you know, she faces a fork in the road when the women's bank opportunity comes up.
Yeah. So she was actually the highest ranking woman in banking in Denver at the time before Women's Bank opened. But unfortunately, it was always a vice president position and she wanted to be president and she knew she could do it. And, you know, her employer also, I suspect, knew she could do it. But they told her, you know, they couldn't. They wished they could. There was no ability to do it to the point where push came to shove and she had this incredible opportunity to take a great risk and join Women's Bank. And she decided she was going to do it. As president, we'll make sure we, you know, and CEO, yeah.
And so finally, was the bank a success?
I would say that's a very enthusiastic yes. It was not only a success in terms of, you know, they capitalized at 2 million. They wanted to get a million in deposits on their opening day, and they did. They got so many more millions in deposits going forward. They ended up helping other banks out when they were financially in distress. They ended up adding car loans, I want to say, like all kinds of different things over the years. And of course, promoting tons and tons of women and helping to fund things like, I guess, so so John Hickenlooper, his brewery, Tattered Cover, the bookstore, the independent bookstore, dozens and dozens of small businesses, one called Gusterman Silversmiths, which is like a famous business out in Denver. The bank has since sold twice, but there are original depositors who still have money in it. So that tells you the loyalty and the success right there, I think.
Okay, we've been talking to Grace Williams about her new book, Give Her Credit. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Joining us now by phone is Jack Danos. He's the founder of Cold Slayer Socks, a new startup to try to address an old problem of cold feet for winter sports participants. What are Cold Slayer socks and how do they work?
Yeah, that's a good question. So these are a new type of heated socks that we've developed to keep your feet warm and solve the age-old problem of freezing cold toes when you're outside in the winter time. So whether you're skiing, snowshoeing, hiking, or just doing the day-to-day, like walking your dog or shoveling snow or working outside, these socks keep your feet warm. So, right, how do they work? Good question. Inside of our socks, we have developed and patented a new type of fluid heat exchanger. And that might sound kind of bulky and uncomfortable, but trust me, it's thin, it's flexible, it's comfortable. And what it does is actually harness the heat that your body is already producing, specifically from your warm legs. Your calf muscle is a nice big heater. So our system absorbs the heat from your leg and transfers it down, circulates it with fluid through small little tubes to a little pouch that's under your toes. And every time you take a step, you're actually pumping fluid through that system by stepping on it. So as long as you're active, your feet just never get cold.
So how did you come up with this idea, Jack?
Yeah.
That's a good one, too. It was almost 10 years ago, actually. And, you know, this might be a kind of a familiar story. You're out on a ski lift and your feet are freezing cold. And at this point, I have to give credit to my dad because we're next to each other. And he's always trying to think of better ways to do things. It's how I've always grown up. And he's like, man, my feet are always freezing out here, but my legs are always a whole lot warmer. And so if there was a way that we could get that heat from our legs down to our toes, we might be able to keep them warm without batteries or those shake-up chemical packs or any of the existing ways. Because he's used the battery-powered boot heaters for years and just was never happy with them. So we knew there had to be a better way, and that's when we started working on it.
Now, do you have to, if you're sitting on a chairlift and you have these on, do you have to pump your toes to just keep it pumping from your calf to your toes?
That's a good one. So you do, if you sit totally still and don't shift your weight at all, they will slowly start to cool off because you do have to have a little bit of movement. If it's a super cold day, you might have to, you know, every minute or two, just kind of wiggle your toes a little bit. But it's not, you don't have to sit there like pump, pump, pump. It's not anything like that. It's almost just like your normal body movement and shifting around is enough.
And, you know, at a high theoretical level, this all makes sense, but the devil's in the detail. Talk to us a little bit about the technology problems you've had to overcome. What kind of fluids do you use? What kind of tubing do you use? And how long did that take to work out?
Yeah, so a little bit of that is still kind of our kind of secret. Okay. But what I can tell you that the fluid is water-based. It's, you know, some people think, well, the fluid is what's generating the heat. It's really not. The fluid is just carrying the heat from one spot to another. And the tubing is actually have been a big challenge because, you know, this whole system, the tubes that run down the side of your leg, it's only about a millimeter thick. And so we've struggled from a long time ago with big bulky systems that were warm but uncomfortable to now we've got this super streamlined technology, but we've actually had to develop the manufacturing methods ourselves. Nobody could make this system for us. So that's been a big challenge is getting it streamlined, getting it durable and all those things and flowing well through the system.
So the socks aren't any thicker than my normal ski socks?
So the system itself only adds about a millimeter. You know, our goal has been to make it comfortable in a ski boot. That's the gold standard. You know, if it's comfortable in a ski boot, it's comfortable in anything because they're so tight and restrictive. My dad used to have custom molded ski boots, and so that's what we did a lot of our testing with. You don't have to size up your boots or anything like that. You just wear them like normal socks.
And what are some of the problems? You mentioned the battery technologies. Could you share with the audience a bit about your perspective on the problems with the existing heating technologies, the chemical packs and the batteries?
Yeah, you know, you don't really have to look far into them to see that there are a lot of problems. If you've ever used them, you're probably familiar with them. From the battery side, you know, your options are either boot heaters or battery-powered socks or heated insoles, anything like that. They all suffer from a few key issues, one of them being that you have to recharge them. They don't always last for a long time, especially if the batteries are a year or two old. And then a big thing that a lot of people don't know is there's actually like a burn risk associated with both batteries and those chemical packs. You know, there are reports, if you just look it up, there are reports of second and third degree burns from these, you know, starting fires in hotel rooms because when they go haywire, I'm serious, when they go haywire and short out, it's a problem. Not to mention the waste they generate, you know, you're throwing away batteries if they're not properly recycled. And then those chemical packs, man, they just pile up in the trash. Over 2 billion of those shake-up chemical hand warmers are used every year and thrown away because they're one-time use.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about where your company is going to be based and, you know, where you're going to be able to do the manufacturing.
We're based out of Logan, Utah. So we're just up a little bit north of you. And we're actually making these right here. We're building our own facility. You know, I mentioned earlier that we've had to develop a lot of these technologies. And so we've brought the manufacturing in-house so that way we can produce a top-notch product and make it right here in Utah the best materials we can source from around the world.
I understand the product is available for pre-order on Kickstarter. When do you expect to be able to ship?
So right now we are targeting January 2026, so about 10 months or so from now. Since we're making them ourselves, it's not as traditional of a process where you just go to your manufacturer and say, hey, I need 5,000 pairs of these. Okay, they'll be ready in 90 days. You know, we're building the machines over here to make these. We're doing it ourselves. And so we're going to get them out as soon as we possibly can while making sure there is good of a product. But this Kickstarter is a great chance for pre-orders and for people who are excited about them to be the first in line to get them. And potentially the only way you're going to get them for next season is ordering them on Kickstarter.
And where are you in terms of corporate fundraising? Have you met your targets for Kickstarter funding?
Yes, so on Kickstarter, we set a goal of $10,000 for pre-orders. We actually hit that in 2 hours on the first night, and we're up over 200% of that. So we're doing great.
Okay, Jack, before we go, website. If people are sitting there with cold toes, wanting to be able to warm up next January, where do they go?
Coldslayer.com. Uh-huh. Super simple.
All right.
And can they get to the crowdfunding from your website?
Absolutely. Okay. There's a right on the first page. There's a click here to pre-order button. You click there, and there you go.
All right. We've been talking to Jack Danos, Coldslayer Socks. Thanks for spending time with us this morning, and happy St. Patrick's Day. We're joined in the studio by Larry Abrams and Jason Lehrman, and on by they're going to talk to us about the culinary takeover that's coming up soon. And we guess we'll start by asking, what's a culinary takeover?
So, I mean, the idea, the inception, and the name of it is kind of what throws people off. It's more of a culinary showcase, let's call it. Mm-hmm. But the culinary takeovers, we're going to bring in these two famous Food Network chefs, and they're kind of going to kind of assist in taking over our restaurants, basically. So they're going to come in and display their skills, their style of cooking for the public here in Park City. And so the idea is that they're just going to take over the restaurants.
So how's it going to work functionally? For a certain number of days, there'll be guest chefs in the restaurants?
Yeah, so how it's going to work is on Tuesday night, both celebrity chefs will be arriving in town. We'll do a meet and greet with our in-house guests. Wednesday night is a Jeff Morrow takeover of La Stellina, our fine dining Italian restaurant. Then on Thursday night is a take, or Wednesday night is the takeover with Jeff Zakarian at Rhyme, our fine dining steakhouse. And then on the final night, it's a wine dinner between all of us chefs here at the St. Regis and our celebrity chefs that are coming to partake with us.
Do we have Jeff?
I don't see Jeff here.
All right, because I was going to ask you what he was planning for La Stellina, but I'm not going to make you spoil his thunder unless you know. Do you know what he's got planned?
I mean, I've got a couple of things. He's got some classic dishes that he grew up from his mother, some old Italian East Side Chicago style of dishes. So he's going to do some short ribs. He's going to do a playoff of like a Detroit Deep South pizza. He's got his own brand of like jardinera and things like that he's going to bring in from Chicago just to kind of highlight his own goods and stuff like that, which is kind of cool.
And this will be this coming Tuesday?
No, this will be the following Tuesday. So it starts the 25th. 26th, 27th, and 28th.
And can people not start? Are you taking reservations now for these events?
Reservations are wide open. The books are open. We want to fill all the seats we can. The wine dinner is a little bit more exclusive. That's a 40-seat kind of environment. That's going to be $500 a person, 40 seats maximum. All the guests that arrive will be able to go home with a care package, gifts from our wineries, gifts from Chef Works, gifts from the local sponsors that we have here in town.
And with this, let's start with the La Stellina evening. Is that going to be a fixed price menu, or are you going to be able to order different things? How will that work?
So how it works is we're taking our regular menus that we have, we're consolidating them, and then highlighting the items that
the specials
that the celebrity chefs are going to bring to us. So Jeff Morrow has his own 6 items that he's going to highlight. The next day, Zakarian has his 6 items that he's going to highlight. We will have some other things that we're going to be able to offer. But at the end of the day, it's more of a highlight of bringing these chefs in that we get to share their talents and their skills and then share it with Park City.
Now, who's joining us this morning?
We have my executive sous chef here, the man, the myth, the legend, Jason Larman.
So, Jason, are you getting to do some special things for this event yourself?
Yeah, so the wine tasting, I have the honor of having one of the 6 course, I believe?
Yep.
Yeah. 6 courses.
Yeah, the 6th course. So all of us will do a collaboration. We'll go down the line, and then everybody will have fun. They'll get to meet and greet us. Q&As, all that good jazz.
Oh, so you'll actually get to meet the people as part of this event?
Yeah, they'll all be there. They all get to see us. And we all get to be sitting there in a nice, shiny white chef coats and having fun.
Larry, have you done anything like this before?
I have at a smaller scale in California before I arrived here in Park City. We kind of do what we call a chef series. And so the idea is to bring the community of culinary chefs together and not kind of be one against each other, be one creatively together. So the idea is to kind of bring all of our skills together, no one's ego gets in the way, and we get to share the idea of cooking good food for great people. And so that's the idea behind the whole thing, is share our love for food with the public.
And you're bringing in some pretty well-known names. Tell us a little bit about each of the chefs.
So Jeff Morrow is the sandwich king for the Food Network. He obviously has one of the more popular shows in the morning called The Kitchen. Jeffrey Zakarian is a nominated and judge for Iron Chef, was an Iron Chef finalist and became an Iron Chef for the Food Network in 2011, and then also has his show with Jeff Morrow called The Kitchen. But both of them are kind of one and the same. They call themselves comedians. We all laugh at it, but they're celebrity chefs with the idea of they like to give back, and the idea of giving back is teaching the next generation, but at the same time sharing their gifts with the public and sharing their ideas and their tools and the simplicity of how they make food. And so that's the idea.
Now, you mentioned that at the big dinner, there'll be some conversation with the chefs. At the other evenings, will the public have the opportunity to learn about a little from the chefs? Will they come out and talk to people on the other evenings as well?
So the 100%. The idea is to let the celebrities, let's call them.
Walk
the dining room and be able to meet and greet and share their stories with the public. The idea is to bring these people in that some feel are untouchable or unable to communicate or have that one-on-one conversation, but we're going to give the public that opportunity to kind of pick their brains and ask the questions that you don't really get a chance to ask.
Now, I'm a little curious. Obviously, this is going to be a big event. I suspect you're going to draw a lot of people to it because it sounds pretty like a lot of fun. Why did you choose to do it during ski season?
First of all, it's spring break, so they both have children. So
it's a good answer.
It's easy for them. but then we also wanted to captivate the majority of the public when they're here in town.
Right.
Summer's a little bit of a different thing. It is starting to grow here in Park City, but we wanted to highlight when we had the actual people and the diversity of people, right? We're not just going to have locals. We're not going to have anybody. We're going to have people from all over the country here celebrating spring break and the last part of the ski season. So we felt it was a great time to have this kind of event for the public.
Okay. Again, how does this fit into your sort of overall, you know, obviously dining at the same, at your hotel is pretty wonderful. Talk to us a little bit about how, you know, do you have any sort of plans for changing any of the dining rooms? Anything new on the horizon coming?
I mean, that's a good question. So we have a lot of things in the work here. As you know, I don't know if anybody's familiar, but we just won Best of Best Park City for Restaurant Rhyme. We just earned our four star for Forbes as well in the restaurant. So I wouldn't say there's too much coming up in the future, but there will be some dynamic change in the way we serve food and the way we look at food.
And while you're here, just for our audience who isn't that familiar with Rhyme, tell us a little bit about the menu range. What would I see if I went to Rhyme?
So Rhyme, the idea behind Rhyme is sourcing local seafood from the east and western coast. So we source all our fish from day boats out of Hawaii and New England. And then we source all of our local game here within about 100 miles of the area. So we keep everything kind of local to Wasatch and to the Wasatch area. When you come into the restaurant, you'll find anything from a simple Caesar salad all the way up to a high-end 60-day dry-aged porterhouse. So it's just things like that, bringing things that the normal restaurant you would see on Main Street isn't going to carry. We have the ability to kind of take it to the next level just based on our price point and where we're at on the mountain. So we try to give that authentic experience, but at a mountainside.
Once again, if people want to learn more about the takeover, where would they go?
They go to our website, stregis.com, Deer Valley, obviously, and search under the restaurant bar. It'll give you the email address to Melinda Rogers, or you can just call the front desk at the hotel, transfer you to reservations, and then you go about going that way. We are on a Google type force, so you can go online and just kind of pick out your phone and make a reservation on your own, whatever time works for you, and it'll tell you what times are available at the same time.
Cool. Well, one last question. So which chef is the best?
I'd say the two that are sitting right here.
There we go. That's got to be the answer.
The ones that showed up.
Okay. There you go. Okay. All right. Well, unless there's anything else you want to add to tell our audience before we go?
We do have our sister restaurant, that's La Stellina, so, you know, fresh homemade pasta, all that Italian flair, as long as we also, you know, we're starting to work into our sushi program for the summer. Piggyback off what Larry said, you know, we did win some awards and we're going to keep pushing the needle forward. We're going to do progression, not digression, because at the end of the day, the hotel is the best address in Utah for a reason. And that's what we're here for, to make sure that it stays the best address and keep moving the needle forward.
All right.
So more to come, more fun. And yes, I'm the silent slayer of the chefs. He knows it. So I'll beat everybody.
There it is. Now we know who the best chef is. Larry Abrams, Jason Lerman, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Well, it is St. Patrick's Day, as we mentioned earlier, and joining us is, we have our representatives from right across the alley, Flanagan's.
Flanagan's, John Kenworthy and Yvonne Timar.
Good morning, you guys. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
So I don't
Kevin
know.
Kevin and Roger, we're about to turn the tables on you. We're going to quiz you and see what you know about St. Patrick and St. Patrick's Day.
Okay, I'm up for it. Rod, you up for it?
I don't know. I think you've got an ethnic advantage on me, but I'll do the best I can for a Goldman. Let's go.
Hey, man, I'm from Brooklyn. You know, I don't know what part of Ireland that is. But
Kevin, you better step up.
There we go.
And,
all right, Yvonne.
Ivani, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
All right, guys. Where was St. Patrick born?
Ireland.
Incorrect.
London.
Britain is correct.
Wow.
Now, how did he make his way over? How did he make his way over to Ireland?
He was the first one to swim the English Channel.
Well, you're 0-2. You're going to be washing dishes. You're going to be washing dishes real soon. St. Patrick was sold into slavery and brought across it to Ireland. All right. Shamrock is well known as the symbol hope, love, and faith. What did St. Patrick promote the symbol as, the Irish symbol?
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
So the three leaves of a clover.
Oh, okay. Love, hope,
represented
and faith.
As love, hope, and faith today. But when St. Patrick's came over, he promoted it as?
Hope.
Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Of
think Christianity.
Come
on.
One.
Okay, 0 for 3.
Again, ethnic disadvantage. Go ahead.
Roger, you're going to be our doorman today. All right.
Roger's going to be the doorman?
Can yeah, you're going to
me in
wash
without
dishes
standing in line?
Takes me back to my college job. Go ahead.
There you go.
Okay. Here, why do we celebrate St. Patrick's Day on March 17th?
Okay, I'm going to phone a friend.
No, come on. Come on.
On March 17th.
Is that his birthday?
We honor people on their
birthday?
Death.
Close.
Date of death.
When he died.
There you go.
All right, we're going to give you that one.
All
right.
All right. We got one.
Ding, 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 ding.
All right. There you go. What does drowning the shamrock mean?
Can we say that on public radio?
It means having a drink.
Having a drink.
Drowning the shamrock.
Yeah, okay. That one we got. I got to give us that one.
All right. And St. Patrick encouraged the drowning of the shamrock on his birthday. All right. Last but not least.
What's his birthday?
I'm sorry, on St. Patrick.
He encouraged it from the grave?
He encouraged it always.
Oh, okay.
He always encouraged a little drowning of the shamrock.
Good.
He was supporter.
Nice.
He was not into prohibition.
Okay.
All right, and that's one of the reasons why we have such a special drinking day today.
Nice.
All right, the last but not least. Is St. Patrick a saint?
No.
That's correct.
He's not.
He started the canonization process, but he never made it all the way through. The miracles never quite happened. Now, with an open canonization, it stays open, so it could happen in the future if the Pope takes him to that next level.
So if he's not a saint, why is he commonly called St. Patrick?
Because culturally, he was such a religious leader over there when he came over and, you know, had survived
being sold into
slavery and everything.
So a little bit more about the life of St. Patrick. So he's sold into slavery, comes to Ireland. Tell us about his career as a canonical?
So he escapes the slavery, he goes back to Britain, and he becomes a bishop. And then he comes back over to Ireland and, you know, becomes this iconic Catholic leader.
So was he a priest when he was sold into slavery?
No.
Didn't he have to be a priest to become bishop?
Well, that's why he went back to England.
England, I gotcha.
And he became a bishop and returned now as a free man and a bishop, as a religious leader.
Now, how has the modern... How's a modern celebration of St. Patrick's Day evolved? How have we gotten to where we are today?
That's a great question. It leads into what I wanted to do here. So we've brought you to a Guinness glass with some green water.
Water.
Green water.
Only water in the studio. Okay.
Really?
I want the ABC to understand this.
Yes. Cheers.
All right. Now, what has happened is this phenomena called splitting the G. Guinness is now the second, third highest selling beer in the world. What happened is these kids in a London pub created this little game and put it on Instagram and Facebook and everything. And what you have to do, and this is to redeem yourself so you won't have to wash dishes, you're going to go against Devon, and your first drink has to take the top of the beer and split the G on the Guinness glass.
Right,
so
there.
Are you ready, Kevin?
Absolutely ready.
Now let's see if you can beat Devon. You have to take one gulp and go right to there, or two gulps, but just don't pull the glass away until you've split the G. One, two, three. Okay, let me look.
How'd you go on the water?
Oh,
he split the G on the water. Nice job.
I may have had a Guinness or two in my past.
I wish we could send out the picture. Kevin hit the home run. He redeemed himself.
Phew,
he
no dishes
split
tonight.
The G.
Okay, so let's talk about what we're likely to see tonight if we make our way over to Flanagan's and get past that large hulking doorman. How many pints of Guinness will you go through tonight?
Or kegs?
You can probably go in kegs, right? How many kegs do you think
about? I'm thinking around 20 kegs.
20 kegs,
which
is how many gallons?
Oh, my gosh.
That's probably, we don't want to get too crazy, but that's a lot of Guinness.
That's a lot of Guinness.
And how many? 125 glasses of keg.
Okay, so we're going to do 20. That's a lot.
2,500
Bet the
pints.
Over. Yeah. Bet the over.
Bet the over.
Yes.
And then how many bottles of Jameson's?
So the Jameson and so Guinness were number one. We're very proud of our Guinness. We're number one in the state for 15 straight years. They've been kind enough to honor my wife and I and take us over to Dublin and tour us and do the whole thing. And it's nice to have one pub in the middle of Main Street if you're going to compete on a state, if you're going to compete on a statewide level.
Yeah.
Anyway, and Jameson, we're number two. We just never get over the hump and beat this one bar, unnamed bar down in Salt Lake. So Guinness, we're number one, and Jameson, we're number two.
Excellent. And what's the address on Main Street for people?
438 Main Street.
What time do you open?
We're opening at 11 a.m.
All right. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
I have one more question for you guys. So what's more rare, four clover leaf or three clover leaf?
Three.
Three is more rare.
No, it's four.
It is four.
Yeah,
all right.
So one out of 10,000.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money Podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.